Concession number 13253, Jim Forrest, Reel 6.
In the world working for the peace movement.
Yes, this is interesting. This is Jim Forrest, Reel 6.
Yes, I've sometimes joked, but it's not entirely unserious comment, that the peace movement's biggest contribution to preventing World War III was taking some of the most dangerous people in the world safely out of the military and away from all weapons so that they could do the least harm possible. Well, thank God there are many outstanding people in the peace movement. But you do find in any protest movement people who are very unhappy, and whose unhappiness shows in a lot of ways, and who want to pour out their animosities in, through movements. And I don't think it does much good for them or for the world, to tell you the truth, but it's bound to happen. Anyway, we moved the office up to Alkmaar. I had some friends that I knew through Thichtenhout Han who lived in that particular small Dutch city. There was an old monastery, medieval monastery, that was undergoing restoration, and they were looking, it was church-owned, they were looking for suitable tenants, and we were quite suitable, in fact, and they were happy to have us, gave us a wing, nominal rent, and I think within a year, the IFOA was in pretty good shape. It was a wonderful experience to see how quickly things can be mended. The committee was, we began to reassert the religious identity of the group, which had been very much in recess. It had been one of, like so many things, 60s and 70s had been a time of great secularization and of religious things being shoved under the carpet as much as possible, erased altogether. And this had happened to the IFOR, this sort of secular humanistic kind of message that it was projecting, and I felt, and I think it came clear at the council meeting we had that spring in April of 77, that there was quite strong feeling that, yes, indeed, we are a religious organization. What brought us to this work, whatever we are, whether we're Catholics or Protestants or Buddhists or whatever we are, Jews, we had certainly a number of Jews there, that let's create us, recreate the IFOR. It was simply there to be recreated. It wasn't something we were inventing, as a place where this is very much upheld, and that people are encouraged to not just to have a religious faith, but to feel free to communicate it, to speak out of their core and not off some edge of themselves. And then, of course, to think about what we could be doing. I don't remember the program decisions way back then. I'd have to look at old issues of the IFOR magazine, but IFOR exists in national branches all over the world. There's plenty of things to do. We had a very large job on our hands. There were new groups coming into being. IFOR is taking root now in Africa, quite deep roots. It wasn't true at all at that time. Many things have happened over the years. We hadn't begun to rebuild work in Eastern Europe at that point. The East-West program wasn't started. By 1980, 81, I think we really were well on our way, and that the organization is now in quite good shape. You know, when I came, they didn't know whether they'd have my salary for 6 months. You see, the treasurer was against appointing me, not because there was anybody else to appoint, but because he thought we have, it's irresponsible to bring a family to Holland when we can't be sure that we have a salary for them for the second half of the year. I slept on a mattress on the floor for months. You know, it was very, very rough landing. But we felt great. We were washing dirty diapers in a machine that hadn't been used by civilized people in many, many years. It was an antique. You know, we'd gotten it from some junk store. It was quite an awful thing to do. But it was at times grueling. But I think really, we both, Laura and I, felt very privileged that. To be involved in bringing the IFOR, helping to bring the IFOR back to life. And not even back to life, but giving it an esprit de corps that was desperately in need of.
Yes, and from what you were saying, it became truly international.
Oh, well, of course it was international, but it had ever since its founding in 1919, it had, by definition, because of the involvement of all the different national branches, it couldn't help but be international. But it was limping along. Some branches were hardly experienced themselves as being connected to it. They were simply national branches. The American FOR hardly thought at all about the international FOR. For example, that was the biggest branch. I don't know. The British FOR was certainly busy with itself and not thinking too much about the other branches. There wasn't much sense of interconnection. There was a formal structure of interconnection, but it didn't mean very much. Today, I think the average FOR member probably does feel like he or she belongs to an international fellowship of reconciliation, which is quite a wonderful thing. That's the way it should be, and was in earlier years. It was a very intensely international movement when it was founded.
Because you would have, the second stage of the Cold War started in, 1979?
Right, with a decision about the modernization of nuclear weapons in Europe.
Yes, did that mean a sort of impetus for you?
Well, yes, it for me, it was... both in terms of my responsibility as General Secretary of the IFOR, and also I have to say in my own inner development, that was proved to be most significant. What triggered a whole new development for IFOR in my life, I don't know, I think this must have happened simultaneously to a number of people. Something's along these lines, but I'll describe it just in my life. I was in America on a speaking trip. I'd gone back and forth across the country. The Freeze campaign was at its height. Now, this was a campaign for bilateral agreement between the United States and the Soviet Union to stop testing nuclear weapons, stop building new weapons of mass destruction, and to stop developing new weapons of mass destruction. It was very simple. A freeze. The Soviet Union, in principle, had committed itself to doing this. Whether they were sincere about it, God only knows. The United States was absolutely against it. And so it was a big selling job in the United States and in Western Europe, but it was mostly in the United States. The peace movement was able, by 1980-81, to get a majority of American people, according to polls, to support the freeze. This was an extraordinary achievement. I was over there at least two times during these enormous organizing efforts. And I can remember, to my surprise, being on the same stage in some place in South Dakota, I don't remember what city, with a general from the Marine Corps, and both of us speaking on the same side, you see. He's a retired general, of course. Nobody in active service would dare to do that, but he was retired. I'm sure he spoke for many who were in active service. He's a fine man and a very professional soldier who was simply looking at things sensibly. I was very excited to see such people taking this stand, and there were ranchers who lived near the Strategic Air Command headquarters and had seen several times the approach of World War III as all the bombers were being hurried into the air and all the nuclear weapons being ready. You know, we were many times, but very close to nuclear war when there were false alarms. We were within minutes. When you talk to people who have been at the places where the minutes were being counted off, it's quite hair-raising to hear them describe what they saw, what almost happened.
Can you think of an example?
Well, I remember at that particular meeting in South Dakota talking to a rancher whose ranch was at the end of the runway where the B-52s take off. And, of course, they're always taking off. They're flying 24 hours a day. They're probably flying at this moment, armed with nuclear weapons, H-bombs. So he said, yes, you take that for granted. But every now and then... you knew that this was not a joke, this was not a rehearsal, this was not... everything was being mobilized, all the sirens were screaming, everybody was running around as if these were the last minutes of their lives. this was not a dry run. This was the real thing. And that when this is what made this man realize that he had to be part of the peace movement. And there was a group of ranchers who went to Moscow at that time. He was one of them, you see. The peace movement was the last place he'd ever imagined to find himself. It was just pure accident of having a ranch where he happened to have a ranch, or pushing around cows next to the Strategic Air Command. You know, cowboy. And cowboy boots and a cowboy hat and all that stuff, and absolutely never had any more political thoughts than the other cowboy has. Well, he was a rancher. I mean, he's a responsible businessman. You can say that, too. And I remember two Air Force officers being lost in Alkmaar one morning. It was a Monday morning. All the stores were closed, as was normal in Holland on a Monday morning. They're trying to find a place to get a cup of coffee or something to eat. I'm walking to my office. There they are looking. I didn't know they were officers at the time. They weren't in uniform. Confused American tourists looking for a place to eat. That was obvious. I said, well, you know, everything's closed. But if you'd like to have a cup of coffee, you're welcome to come into the office and have a cup of coffee. So I invited them in, found out that they were, both of them, Air Force pilots, husband and wife, Air Force pilots, stationed in Germany, coming to Holland for a little vacation, mini vacation. And they realized this is a peace organization. We begin to talk about nuclear war. And I don't remember if it was the husband or the wife or the two of them speaking antiphonally. But they're saying, you know, when we first joined, every now and then you'd have a conversation, what if there were a nuclear war? But now when we have this conversation, it's when. It's no longer if. And they say the most awful thing is that you know that the people that are most precious to you will be the first to die. Because they're all living right next to the base, which is, of course, a prime target, absolutely first rank target. The one nuclear weapon that will certainly explode is right there. And everybody that they're trying to, their children, no one else, all their friends, will be gone, you know. So that even if they live through it, there's hardly anything to live through it for. That was a pretty horrifying conversation. But it was all said very quietly. It came from the depths of the heart, you know. And I think one would have to say the peace movement played a very important part in, thank God, in moving things to a state where probably they're not talking about when at this moment anymore. Maybe another 5 years we'll be back there again. I don't know. We're not out of it yet. So I was in this trip in America. That's what I was talking about before. And I was impressed with the Freeze campaign. But there was something missing. I couldn't quite put my fingers on what it was. I'd never seen so many people coming to meetings. I'd never seen so many Americans showing a concern for disarmament. It wasn't exactly disarmament, but steps that would put the brakes on the arms race and perhaps create a situation in which steps away could be taken. I got to Cambridge, Massachusetts, Harvard. I had a talk to give at Harvard. And a friend of mine who was teaching at Harvard took me out to dinner, and he's a great film lover. And he said, let's go to a film. So I said, fine, what do you want to see? Well, of course, in Cambridge, it's one of the few places in America where you see anything that isn't a mass hit, you know, where they have some interesting films that come from perhaps a funny place like England, for example. I'd see an English film. one of those other odd places outside of Hollywood, you know. Well, it was a Russian film, Soviet film, that we went to see that night. It was the one Soviet film that had received an Academy Award. It had received one some months before. And I don't suppose there were three or four cinemas in America where you could see that movie, maybe even not even another in the whole country that night where you could have been able to see, in the United States at that period, a film made in the Soviet Union. Moscow Doesn't Believe in Tears was the name of the film. I won't bother to tell you the story of the film. It happens to be a very good film. Got an Academy Award for good reason. The thing is that when I came out of the theater, I realized what was missing in the peace movement. That everything was aimed at the danger of nuclear war, the kinds of weapons, what they do, what they cost, what their side effects are, the social dislocations that are caused by spending money in this way. Practically speaking, absolutely nothing was being done by the peace movement to change the relationships between the United States and its allies and the Soviet Union, you see. We knew nothing about the Soviet Union, practically nothing. We received the same information within the peace movement about the Soviet Union that everybody else in the society received, and we had very little else to go by. Most of us, not being communists, wouldn't pay any attention to the stuff coming from the communists and the left-wing people in the peace movement. We knew that was all rubbish. But we didn't really know anything about them. And we didn't really want to. We did, because if we started traveling to the Soviet Union, what would that look like? Going to get our instructions from the Kremlin, meeting with these big shots in the Kremlin, really meeting with the KGB. It would just play into the hands of the Reader's Digest kind of view of the peace movement. So we didn't want to go there. We didn't want to touch it with a barge pole. And yet it was obvious to me that night, and it never ceased to be vivid in my mind ever after, that the only way we could change the arms race was to change the relationship. There was no other way. That Americans would never disarm, and nor would the British, nor would the Dutch, nor would anybody else in the alliance, as long as they had reason to fear the Soviet Union. As dangerous as these weapons are, as destructive as they are even without being used, people would hang on to them rather than go without them. And indeed, we saw what happened to the freeze movement when that 747 Korean airline was shot down by the Soviets. The freeze movement was shot down by the Soviets, too. It crashed with that 747. It was complete ruin from that moment on, because people were reminded, this is why we have the weapons, precisely for this reason. Next day, if you'd taken a poll about the freeze, it would have been quite a different poll than you would have taken the day before. The peace movement, fortunately, I mean, I said, this was what happened to me. I went to see a movie, and it brought home to me what was missing. I'm sure that everybody you could talk to who was involved in more or less designing peace movement work for different organizations, Bruce Kent or you name whoever you want to in any organization that in the early 80s began to get involved in East-West work, they had something happen to them that made them realize this exactly the same thing. And that's why we have a burst of activity that wasn't weapon-centered anymore. That was still there, but it was on the back burner. And the front burner was, we've got to change the way that we relate to the Soviet Union. Groups started to go, serious meetings started to happen, generals started to go, film people went, writers went, all kinds of ordinary activists and peace groups and so forth and so forth and so forth.
Yes, how about yourself? Did you
go? Oh, yes, I went, and I don't think anything that I've done in my adult life has had more impact on me than starting to travel in the Soviet Union. There were many aspects of the work which were quite unpleasant. You'd have to go, for example, and typically, let's say you have a meeting with the Soviet Peace Committee. Believe me, batting your head against a brick wall would be far more rewarding. Not that there weren't people in the Soviet Peace Committee whom you could enjoy talking to, particularly when it was between the official meetings. Some of them would be worth talking to, not a lot, but some. They were all hardcore communists, you know. And they were very closely controlled by the KGB, and probably most of them were KGB themselves, probably, or I would assume so. Doesn't mean that they're not human beings and they haven't got values and you couldn't get someplace in a discussion or make some points that would be important in their own further thinking, etc., but it was very frustrating. So that was the negative side, but you had to do it. It needed to be done. And if you were minded in such a way as we were, you'd also have contact with dissidents and go and visit them in the evenings. People who were putting everything on the line. But for me, the most startling thing, and that just continues to reverberate in my life ever since, was going on a Sunday to the Holy Liturgy in one of the cathedrals in Moscow. I had not been prepared for the vitality of spiritual life in the Soviet Union. I was certainly aware of the repression. I knew all about the Gulag. I knew about the many martyrs. I knew that many thousands of churches and monasteries and all the rest had been closed, practically all the seminaries. What I didn't know was that despite all this, that you would have to travel very far indeed to find spiritual life of this vitality anywhere in the world. The only place I'd ever seen anything like that was in the black community in America. That kind of depth and wholeheartedness. Well, I was simply astounded. I it didn't take me long as a writer to come up with the idea that wouldn't it be great if I could write a book about religious life in the Soviet Union. Well, I was very ill prepared to do it. I didn't speak Russian. I had a lot of other things to do. But I, on the other hand, it's like when you fall in love, you find time for falling in love. You find time for it. It took some years before I finally was able to get through all the different roadblocks that stood in the way on both sides. You know, there weren't too many American or British publishers that were interested in such a book at that time. Would think it would be at least pay for itself, you know. With every publisher thinks, has to think, is this book at least not going to lose money? And on the other hand, even more difficult to remove the obstacles within the Soviet Union. Because it was not something which they were very keen about, having pacifists or anybody else running around talking to people. Few people were singled out as people that Westerners could talk to. All absolutely committed, dedicated communists. And you start going around talking to people in churches, monasteries, seminaries. No matter how carefully this state apparatus tried to control these things, there were always a lot of things that one way or another might happen. You know, Gorbachev wasn't yet General Secretary of the Communist Party. You know the mentality that you were up against. So you can imagine that it wasn't easy, but finally it happened. And I'll never stop being grateful for that, because it had a lot of, in my own life, it had a lot of positive significance.
You went to Eastern Europe as well, did you?
Oh, yes. I was in Czechoslovakia, particularly. East Germany, a number of times. Poland, just a very little bit. People used to talk about the Soviet Union as some kind of a unity, but of course it wasn't. And so I was in different parts of the Soviet Union. I haven't been all the way to Vladivostok. But I've been very close to it. I've been on the Mongolian border. I've been in various parts of Siberia and all through Central Asia and Azerbaijan and most parts of the Ukraine and the Baltic states.
With your knowledge, Russia. You know, built up at this, with your travels at this time,
yeah.
Did it mean that you were perhaps less surprised than other people at what happened under Gorbachev? You know,
no.
The fact that you had witnessed this religious life.
Well, yes, I would say I was as surprised as anybody, but on the other hand, I can remember people saying to me, and it resonated very easily, in given my own religious experience, I can understand what they meant. When people live the kind of spiritual life that is being lived in our church, it will eventually bring about change. Something like that. We knew, we just didn't know when. So we knew that eventually there would be something, somebody like Gorbachev, because if you plant a seed, something will grow from it. So that, in that sense, I wasn't surprised. But I was surprised. I think it's always surprising whenever, you know, it's surprising when the spring comes and you see leaves come out on the trees. You know they're going to come. You've seen it happen many times. It's still absolutely astounding. when it actually happens. You know, a baby, a woman is pregnant, she's going to give birth. The baby is born and you're astounded. So it was astounding in that sense. And to be a witness to the process at close range, of course. I mean, I've talked with Raisa Gorbachev. I've stood in arm's reach of Gorbachev and listened to him talking and answering questions and talking with people at peace conferences. I didn't talk to him myself, but still, you know, you were able to see at a very early stage, before there were even trust in such individuals as Gorbachev in the West, when they were still being treated as simply evil people who were clever enough to smile. I saw Sakharov when he was first allowed back to Moscow, and when Marilyn Monroe had appeared, she wouldn't have attracted more journalists than he did at that moment. I was there. I talked with all sorts of dissidents who were struggling at that time, and I talked with people in different structures of the state and society, some of whom were very forthcoming about what was wrong and what could be needed to be done. Not all the communists were repeating the party line. I watched the slow opening up of mouths as people began more and more to talk openly, ordinary people. You go into a bookshop 1 year and nobody would talk to you. You'd pay your money and you'd go out. The next year, somebody would stop you and say, "Are you an American? Or are you this or that? Well, where do you come from?" And get into some kind of conversation. And 3 months later, they'd be talking to you about what was wrong with the General Secretary of the Communist Party, you see. Just strangers. Or what was this or that or something else, you know, and they're asking you all sorts of questions. Well, they would never have done that in the early 80s or even in 85 or maybe 86, you could begin to see how much things were changing. The ice was melting. But I didn't foresee what it would lead to. Nobody did, as far as I know. And I don't know what, I mean, even now we live with the consequences of the sun freezing, and some of it's pretty dangerous. Sad to say.
Do you think the the peace movement, you know, you were saying this awareness that was generated in the early 80s, that there had to be a relationship,
yeah,
and how there was a change of strategy and tactics. Do you think that was a factor?
Oh, yes.
What happened?
Oh, unquestionably. How could it not be? You have all of a sudden large numbers, I wouldn't say, you know, I don't mean millions, but you have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people coming from Britain, from the United States, from the Netherlands, from West Germany, from Scandinavia, from France and Italy, and from all the other countries in the NATO alliance. People begin to visit the enemy country. And the very first thing that happens to them, no matter who they are, no matter how well-educated they are, no matter how much they know, quote-unquote know, just to see people face-to-face and to be in the place where they live and to enter into discussions, no matter how frustrating or how difficult or unproductive, as so many of them were, puts things in a new light. And then to be riding, I made it a point right away to go off by myself. I never like to be herded around. I can't stand tours. That's not true. There, in an art museum, for example, if there's a good tour guide, I know he'll be happier than me to troop along. That's about the only thing I can think of where I enjoy a tour guide. Apart from that, I prefer to go by myself, off into the subways of Moscow, the metro, and to just ride around. Can't get lost, really. And if you do get lost, and you can get a little bit lost. Some of the stations are very complicated and interconnecting lines and all that. People will help you. You will find your way. And in those days, there was no danger of being robbed. Now, of course, there's quite a great danger. But then there wasn't. Practically one of the safest places in the world was Moscow at that time. So being alone, among crowds of ordinary Russians and other people from different parts of the Soviet Union, was the kind of thing which couldn't help but have quite a considerable effect on you. And of course, anybody who went through this, and I think it would be a rather impressive number of people who did over a period of several years, they come back and every one of them does something about it. Every one of them. Nobody just goes back home to life as usual, and you're desperate to talk to your neighbors and to influence your government and to see what you can do. And of course it adds up to something. So, yes, I think the peace movement can take a certain amount of credit for it. It's one of its better moments. It's one of, to be Churchillian, one of our finest hours.